Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is the Transformation of Value podcast. Today, I talk with Dr. Simon Collins from Stacker, a New Zealand Bitcoin mining company. And we talk about Simon's thoughts on Jason Lowry's latest book about soft power and power projection in a Bitcoin world. We also explore the abstract category of value transfer and how the vantage point of Bitcoin can provide a way to explore this, similar to how the internet provided a new way to look at communication. Now, Simon is always great to talk with, and he'll actually be speaking at the Bitcoin Alive conference in Sydney next month, so check out his details in the show notes to follow along. If you want to get in touch with me, please send an email to hello@thetransformationofvalue.com, and I'll get back to you. I do hope you enjoy this episode. If you'd like to support the show, please consider streaming some Satoshis via your favorite podcasting 2.0 platform, such as Fountain or Breeze. Otherwise, on to the show.
I just came out of a meeting, so I'm sort of context switching. I don't know if you do that a lot with your work, but
right.
Do you just sort of change gears, or do you?
It can be hard to change gears. You bring the energy that you had in your last meeting to the new one, and then sometimes there's a clash with what's going on in the room.
Yeah, so it's sort of like just kind of regrounding, coming back into the Bitcoin world, the world of long-term thinking,
yep.
Stability, and sound money.
Bits and energy.
Yeah.
I was just listening to some Jason Lowry on my way over. Because as we know, his thesis was published this week as a book, the free copy, the thesis copy coming out soon. And so I was listening to an older talk of his about Bitcoin and power projection. Have you kind of followed this stuff of his?
No, but I'm interested. Geopolitics, yeah?
Well, yeah. Yeah, it is geopolitics. I think his application, because he's a defense fellow at MIT, so he's a, you know, and he's in the Space Force, which just sounds ridiculous still. But he, yeah, so his, obviously, his funding and his topic for his thesis are about how, I guess, nations can project power at the, using proof of work, right? So I would probably think it's important to kind of characterize his thesis as a proof of work study, not necessarily a Bitcoin study. Of course, Bitcoin is what, or is the current application of successful proof of work in computer science. So he was looking at, obviously, through the lens of Bitcoin. But he had an interesting talk a while ago about how Bitcoin is its own form of power projection for individuals, because, and let me get this straight in my head because it's fresh. So effectively, we're all exploited. All of our data is exploited constantly, right? That's kind of the model that the internet has kind of taken over time. Facebook and Twitter and all sorts of things. And there's these kind of oligarchs who siphon up your data and use it to create their own ends, their own equity, and their own value. And meanwhile, you're advertised to and you have value extracted from you through, you know, kind of coercive algorithmic or predictive algorithms. So what Bitcoin offers is a means to make accessing your data and your information too expensive for these entities, oligarchs, companies, because you've got your data protected by a network that requires that you expend watts or energy, not computing power, because we're all flush with computing power, but you are required to expend energy to access the information of a person. And when that happens at the level of hundreds, millions, billions of users, it suddenly becomes impossible to fund exploiting users in the same way. And I think this is what we're seeing in Nostr, right? There's this big, everyone's fleeing to Nostr from Twitter because Twitter has become an oligarch's playground in a way that we've never even seen before on this planet. It really feels like in-game social media, right? And so what Jason Lowry is saying is that something like Nostr allows you to operate in the same way that everybody wants to on Twitter, but without the oligarchical oversight and the constant harvesting of your information for the benefit of the owners of the network rather than its users.
Have you used Nostr very much?
I'm trying really hard to get into Nostr.
So I got my first Zap the other day, Or today, actually.
Congratulations. Thank you. Open a bottle of champagne? Or?
No, I just stacked some more sets. That's my enough reward in itself. But what it is using the Dumas app, you know, and you just literally tap someone's profile and you zap them and you send them some Bitcoin over Lightning. Yep. And it's just... and I've been on it since just before, like, because Damas was on test flight. I was using Enigma and a few others before that, and just seeing the exponential growth.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's incredible. And I've got another little story just associated with that. So working on some other Bitcoin stuff and just doing the kind of the hard work of looking at ways to interface with the legacy system and sort of feasibility studies about whether it's even worth it and a few things. And I had a call with an AML KYC service provider who basically helps companies who have the requirement to do KYC, you know, helps them kind of automate and make that process a lot easier. And I must admit, like, I went into it relatively naive. Mm-hmm. I came out of it disgusted, literally disgusted with just how much information, how many databases your information touches. The checks that they run and the way that it's been normalized. And so, for example, you know, you upload your driver's license to a service, whatever it might be, to verify yourself. But what they do is they run these checks like, are you a politically exposed person? They do adverse media checks. They run all of the stuff that is like Five Eyes. It's all there. And you don't, on the front end, you don't see that. You just see, I uploaded my selfie with my ID. But on the back end, all of that's being harvested. And any operator on that service can jump in, see your ID, see your biometrics. And I got the pitch deck from these people because, you know, we were tentatively, ostensibly asking them if, you know, maybe we could use this service. And we won't be, but just as a bit of a research project, kind of understanding what the incumbents are out there. And the way they were able to automate it, it was like the worst of technology and the worst of just whatever this dystopia is.
And again, you know, like, you go into these processes. So first of all, that's horrifying. Mm. Second, you go into these processes thinking that your exchange is, you know, like, you're signing up to an exchange, is the classic one of Bitcoin, right? You need to buy or sell or whatever, or send something. So you sign up to an exchange and you go through that AML process because you assume that that's going to happen. You kind of assume that actually that KYC provider is somehow part of the exchange, right? But it's a third party, and the third party's making money off the sale of your biometrics.
Yeah, and that's exactly what this particular company was offering. And just, I mean, it was smooth. It was like your typical SaaS pitch deck, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was interesting to just kind of be pitched at. And, you know, and me and the other person, you know, from our side who were on the call were just sort of nodding our heads. But I had this just gut. This disgusting feeling come over me, and I had to go for a walk and just get it out of, like, whoa, walk it off, because I was like, wow, this has been normalized to such a degree. And I kind of knew that it was a thing, but now, having seen literally, like, here's the interface, the dashboard where you go in and you can filter by ID type, you can filter, whoa, by, you know, did they have an adverse media coverage, you know, like, if there was a net, so for example, someone had a piece of negative media, which is in itself problematic because, you know, can we trust the media? And then you can filter by that. And then that's what allows someone to make a decision about whether you can use their service or not.
Wow.
And it just made me realize, like, wow, with Bitcoin, because I had a phone call with a friend earlier today who's kind of Bitcoin curious, I guess you could say. And I was like, look, download Wallet Satoshi, hold it up to your video, to your webcam. I'm going to send you some sats.
Yep.
And they were like, wow, did you just do that? Yeah, we just did that. And there was no third party. It just happened. And that is the future. And ultimately, it's like when you treat everyone like criminals, because at the end of the day, the AML laws do not stop money laundering. They enable it by the banks do it already.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's no justification for it from an actual security point of view.
It's always felt like an ambulance at the bottom of a cliff for me. Right, it's like trying to ring fence the entire system to stop something that's already going on inside the system. And, you know, as you say, it absolutely is the banks that conduct most of the money laundering on the planet. You only have to look at the fines that are kind of consistently levied against Bank of America,
HSBC,
What's Jamie Dimon's one? Morgan Stanley? Or
well, it's just a, you know, it's a risk, it's a risk benefit. You know, what's the cost of money laundering and how much we're going to get charged if we get caught doing it? And it's usually cheaper to just pay the bill if they get caught.
Exactly. Know? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Make billions in the meantime. Ask for forgiveness for 600 million later. Yeah. Yeah, that's wild. Just coming back to the Jason Lowry stuff, because your cost benefit analysis point triggered me again. So he talks about that's, you know, that's basically, that's the maths here. Like, when you want to attack somebody for their land or their data, you have to do a cost benefit. And if it costs you more to access or to take over that land than you're going to get from it, obviously you're not going to attack somebody. If it costs you more to access somebody's data than you're going to make from them, then you won't do it as well. So this is the opportunity for Bitcoiners too. And he talks about the kudzu forest, which is a really noxious weed in a lot of the world. It was imported from, you know, from Asia in the early 20th century as a like a ornamental plant, but it takes over entire forests in like the United States. And what it does is it creeps in and it wraps itself around the existing trees, and then it just kind of chokes them off. So he's talking about this for Bitcoin, where we've got an existing internet and the internet is rife with money laundering, cybercrime, and the exploitation of users' data and information. Apparently cybercrime would be the fourth or fifth largest business in the world if you stacked it all up. Like, it would be a business sector like mining, like finance. Like, it would be the fourth or fifth largest, but of course it's hard to put a total figure on it. So cybercrime is extremely prevalent, and the way to stop it, of course, is to make it too expensive to attack people using these existing networks. So when you have to pay for the transaction to send the money, or sorry, to access them, to ask them to send you money, to trick them into a romance scam or a Nigerian prince scam or whatever, if you can wrap a structure around that, like Bitcoin, around the existing internet, take it over slowly from the inside, then you've got an opportunity to dismantle these kind of, these perverse operations that operate within what should be a politically neutral system, but isn't, because it's been monetized, politicized, criminalized over decades. So he talks about our ability to kind of create a space where it's far too expensive, and this is the proof of work argument, it's far too expensive to attack anybody in cyberspace, because you have to expend more than it's ever going to get you in doing so.
Yeah.
Because it's always been a numbers game, right? Cybercrime's a numbers game. Send out 100,000 emails, see if you get 10 bytes.
Yeah.
You have to send out 100,000 zaps to get 10 bytes. You've
got to pay for it.
Yeah. So that's, you know, and this is, I think, I was walking around thinking, geez, does this stuff help or hurt Bitcoin when what we have to do is get so many people who aren't across the line, and then we're saying, well, yes, it's money and a currency and it's a network and it's an asset. Oh, and by the way, it's also like personal protection. It's kind of like, whoa, suddenly it's sounding like one of these as seen on TV kitchen utensils that does too many things and doesn't do any of them well. But in fact, it's the best solution for all of these things. We're kind of trying to peddle something that sounds like it's too good to be true.
Well, I think, yeah, I agree. It's a challenge. When you say it out loud, it sounds a bit ridiculous sometimes. But having done the research, I think what I take from it is, I was reading Marcus Aurelius last night, and he talks about the form, the matter, and the purpose of a thing. And I think what we can talk about with Bitcoin and with any kind of system is, if you look at the purpose and look at where value gets exchanged in anything, then you can actually see that that's where Bitcoin can be part of it. And so I think that the challenge is to take away, to divide the technology and the concept. And so the technology can do anything, and it sounds like it's a kitchen sink that does all things, but it's the concept of value transfer that is being innovated here, just in the way that communication was innovated by the internet. Mm-hmm. And so prior, this is sort of before my time, but, you know, I imagine once upon a time it was like, you know, communication, what does that mean? It wasn't broadly understood under a single category. You know, you had print media, you had the radio, you had maybe television, but it wasn't until the internet was able to bring all of those things into a single channel that there was the ability to even talk about it as a unified concept.
And I think that's a really good point, right? So your idea of communication, we had a very narrow view of communication prior to the internet kind of becoming ubiquitous. And now, as you say, communication has been unified into a single channel, but within that channel, it's been diversified across so many different mediums. I mean, just text chat apps, right? You've got Signal, Telegram, WhatsApp, messages, SMS on an Android phone, all these different channels, and there's probably a bunch I've missed. Then there's voice, then there's written, all that sort of stuff. What we've taken is we've taken the concept of communication and we're blowing it up. Communication now means so many things. It can be multimodal. It can be, you know, through time and space. It can be delayed. It can be one way. It can, you know, can be posted like a newspaper article, or it can be two way. It can often be three way, four way. It can be group chat. We're doing the same thing with transactions, right, in Bitcoin. What's a transaction when you're in a banking system? Well, it's you send me money, or I send you money, or I deposit money and you hold on to it for me. Transaction on Bitcoin is a completely different thing, and we're seeing this massively with ordinals, whether or not you think this is a good idea or not. And with Nostr, we're taking what constitutes a transaction and turning it into a compute, or a change, or a state change, or a recognition of something, or a saving out of something. So we're doing the same thing with transactions as we did with communication. And it's going to be really interesting what a 30-year-old, a 40-year-old Bitcoin, like, which is where we're at with the internet, what that looks like, because we're comparing the internet of, you know, 40 years ago, where it was just like, hey, I've invented a way to send text between two computers, to now, when it's the most ubiquitous single piece of public infrastructure that exists on the planet. What does a 40-year-old Bitcoin look like? That's what I'm excited to hang around for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like, looking at, I think it's a definitional problem. And this is where I think the role of, it sounds a bit cheesy, but the role of artists, philosophers, you know, people interested in culture, and some of the soft pieces around the edge are really important. Because, I mean, this is a media studies process, you know, looking at this real time, how this evolves. And something BitKiwi Paul actually mentioned, you know, is talking about how, you know, the internet used to go over phone lines, and then now phone lines go over the internet. And so I think just the ability to recognize that there is a category of thing called value transfer, and that thing can be encapsulated under Bitcoin, and all things that are value transfer can be captured by that. And so that is, you know, again, the matrix that I always come back to is hyperlocal, hyperglobal, and then macro and micro. And so something like an API call to a server can be monetized with Lightning, you know. And so every, you know, instead of having something that needs to be gated, you can just pay as you go with an API.
That's a really, and you know what? You can imagine so many applications of something
like that.
Like that.
You know, whether it's email or whatever. So that's a micro hyper global transaction. Then you've got hyper global macro transactions, such as international settlement of large large funds. But then you've got hyper local, you know, buying something from your neighbor.
Yeah.
And then hyper local micro, like, hey, you know, just tipping someone. So there's all of these like things that can be captured under there. And that's where I really like value for value. And, you know, with podcasting or with online content, paywalls, online news, there's just so many areas where the way value is transferred and engaged with is kind of not really working correctly. And Instagram, it's like, you know, I maintain a pretty big Instagram page for my photography, and, you know, I've never been able to make a single cent from a like. You know, maybe I've sold some product, but I've never been able to actually get compensated for my work. Whereas if you were able to say every time you like, it's 10 cents. That's a totally different ball game.
And again, like what we were saying earlier about the exploitation of users by large corporates, you're not making any money off posting your work on Instagram, but Instagram is, because they use your page as a landing page for advertising.
I've made more money off Nostr just from people paying my invoices than I ever made off Instagram.
Exactly. So, you know, like, it's a very perverse system that we currently exist under, and it needs subverting. Now, there is business to be done in the Bitcoin-centric, Lightning-based social media world. Like, I'm seeing on Twitter a lot, people were saying, hey, come on over Nostr. I made $230 from this tweet because it's getting so many zaps. You know, that's like a complete inversion of the business model, because now you've got the users getting paid for their content in the way that the businesses have been getting paid to date.
Yeah. And I mean, absolutely. And even with this podcast, like, it's still kind of humble days at the moment, but I'm like, wow, just the signal that I've been receiving from people who are like, you know, Boostergrams, people streaming sets to the show. Like, I'm like, this is a thing, you know, like, because I had another podcast previous to this, which was exploring similar themes just around, you know, value and kind of my creativity and sort of aligned topics. But our ability to monetize that was super limited because it was a niche topic. You know, we're not getting millions of downloads. And so advertisers wouldn't be interested. And you couldn't, you know, Spotify, YouTube, they don't care. And ultimately, those platforms, because you need scale to even be on the chart, you end up creating this kind of cookie cutter content. But ultimately, you know, we're in the internet, which is long tail by definition. It's niche by definition.
I'm sorry, are you not trying to create BitBoy New Zealand?
Sorry?
Are you not trying to create BitBoy New Zealand? Because that's what I'm here for, man. Yeah. Well, I thought we were going to start screaming at a green screen in a minute.
No. But I mean, you know what I mean, though. Like, it's a niche that we can monetize because there's enough people out there. And it's like, we had this little blip of mass media from, say, post-World War II through to the 80s, where it was like television was it. And we're still kind of following that. It's like, yeah, CNN, BBC, like all of these kind of like legacy institutions, which have hijacked our understanding of media. Whereas actually, like, historically, it's always been decentralized. You had local newspapers, local coverage. Yeah. I mean, that was a whole thing. And even in New Zealand, like regional newspapers, which have all been brought up now. So they're all basically owned by the big media companies. Whereas actually having like niche media where you can get your news from, or, you know, just, you know, engaging with people through niche media. I mean, that's the natural way that it should be.
It is. And unfortunately, it's become incredibly hard to monetize. I mean, I remember having a discussion with some people about their plan to launch a food related and very local business, you know, like a media business. And I was like, man, it's such a, because they were all about telling the stories of local producers, local growers, and retailers of food. I thought it's such a great and lofty idea, but I don't know how you're going to sell it, either like within the region, certainly, but how are you going to sell it outside the region? That's a real challenge. But I guess if you can find your piece of that long tail, then awesome.
Yeah, and it's all about the long tail. And I think as Lightning and this concept sort of grows further, because I think one of the challenges sort of being devil's advocate is that, sure, doing a Bitcoin focused podcast or newsletter or something is something that Bitcoiners can support. But that said, I think we are slowly pushing the boundaries of the topics that have been covered. I mean, it is already quite a lot broader than just Bitcoin. And even this show, I often talk about other topics. But that's, you know, in the future, there will be things that are maybe Bitcoin adjacent or whatnot, but they're not specifically Bitcoin, but they're still being able to be supported. You know, things like health, you know, healthy living, creativity, art, music, like different things. And I mean, you're starting to see that. I saw there was a new service coming out, sort of an alternative to Spotify, which is for streaming music and, you know, being able to earn sats.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. And Fountain as a podcast application as well. You know, it's the services are being built, and I guess it's just on us as Bitcoiners to use them, make sure we do use them. And I'd love to find a way to cross tweet and Nosta post as well, just so that I'm not kind of creating extra work for myself.
Yeah, no, so it's really interesting. And I think circling back to what you're talking about with Jason Lowry, like the you know, the idea of power projection, you know, because I'm very interested in you know, geopolitics and just sort of macro things that are happening, and looking at, say, the way wars and just international interventions are able to be funded and justified. Often it's only possible under these kind of fiat systems where money can be printed and munitions can be made from that printed money and sent to use in wars.
Yep.
And that's kind of kinetic war. But if you have to pay for the thing, it's very, very challenging to make that argument to you.
Have you seen his original hand-drawn diagram?
Which one's that?
There's a great hand-drawn diagram, and I'll send you a copy so that you can put it in the show notes. But it's a diagram he drew, I think, in a lecture or in a discussion with somebody, and it's kind of become the kind of the core of his thesis, which is that if you tokenize everything onto Bitcoin, right, you take your equities, your gold, your bonds, your cash, everything that makes your country, your land, your settlement valuable, and you turn it into tokens on Bitcoin or Lightning, and you then distribute it around the world in tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of nodes, and you have it supported by a global computing network that protects it from attack, then what do you blow up? You've got nothing to blow up. You can't target every single computer that holds all of this stuff to take over this country. Let's say Singapore is a great example because it's small, and they take all of the property and its ownership, tokenize that on Bitcoin. All of the equity in all the companies, that's in tokens, that's on the blockchain. So everything that's kind of physically held or paper held is now on the blockchain. And then you go try and invade Singapore and you go, well, give me all your stuff. And they say, take it. And who are you going to take it from? What are you going to take it from? You can't take it from anything because it's distributed. It's impossible to confiscate because it's Bitcoin and it's on Bitcoin. So everybody who's remembered their 12 password phrases disappears into the woodwork, and you can't confiscate any of the stuff. People yeah. still own it. You can take it by pure force, but that means putting a soldier on every street corner or outside every building for the rest of your occupation of this place, and that becomes extremely expensive when you can't extract any of the value from it because it's all distributed and you can't access it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, I often think that the value, like, with Bitcoin, you know, it's always going to be more valuable for everyone to trade than to fight. And, you know, Bitcoin is money for everyone. Even if you've got a different belief system or, we disagree on certain things, if we're trading, it's likely that we're not fighting. And, I mean, maybe you could tie the development of hard money with periods of, you know, less war. And periods of fiat money to pay for war is more aggressive periods in time. I mean, I'd be interested in some of the historical analysis of that. But certainly it's like, well, what are you going to blow up?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and
yeah.
and who's going to pay for the weapons?
Yeah.
Because those weapons are not creating value for anyone.
Yeah.
It's like the ultimate fiat kind of underscore is spending money on, you know, $100,000 missiles and weapons that,
well, it's cost benefit, right? If it costs you more to create the weapons than it does when you invade and attack somebody to secure the value that they have locked in their land, then you won't do it.
Mm.
We'll probably see that play out all over the world. I mean, why has China not invaded Taiwan? It'd be extremely expensive to do so. Too expensive because, to your point, they trade extensively with the USA, and the USA trades extensively with Taiwan and have pledged their support and protection to that particular island. And so it's too expensive for China to invade them.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, this is a bit beyond my understanding here, but I know there's just been a lot of discussion around the evolution of war and sort of, was it, you know, fifth generation war, these ideas that, you know, we're already in the next war. It's not a kinetic war that we see on the surface, but it's an information war. And I find that interesting. It's a bit pessimistic, so I don't look into it too much because I think Bitcoin can fix a lot of this just by its own virtues. But it's like, yeah, we are in a saturated information environment, and the naivety of a lot of people to media, which is very clear to me in New Zealand, like I think in a lot of other countries, is like this implicit understanding that the media are lying to you. But it's like, yeah, people take it at face value still when they still watch the 6 o'clock news. And I'm like, wow, what are you doing? You know, you're being programmed to think this. And it's become more and more clear that that's the way it's operating. Whereas if you get, you know, you're on your Nosta channel, you're getting kind of direct citizen journalism. You're seeing what's actually going on. And it's like, it can feel quite lonely, I think, in a way. Like, you're not sure sometimes, like, is this really the take on truth? But in a post-truth world, which we live in, it's very, it's very difficult, and I feel a lot more trust towards these decentralized outlets than I do to a mainstream, you know, legacy institution.
I think realistically, the information you're getting is only as good as the person you're getting it from. Mm-hmm. And their ability to construct in their own brains what their understanding of a situation is and then articulate it to you is kind of a key factor, or are the key factors in whether or not that person is trustworthiness in what they're having to say. You know, because there's so much news that's not really news, right? Fox News is not really news.
That's entertainment.
That's entertainment.
Infotainment.
Yeah. There are so few people that you can actually kind of look at or listen to and trust for, you know, truth and information. And I know that I, we have all these inherent biases. We all seek out the news source that satisfies our own biases, right? Yeah. I know that I read The Guardian because I'm slightly left leaning, and that satisfies my biases because they're tougher on Donald Trump than they are on Jacinda Ardern. But you know, if your biases swing the other direction, then you seek out the other end, and that's why we're also polarized. You know, yeah. We all want to feel good when we read the news, but unfortunately, that's not the way it works.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I think also quite unhealthy, just that constant fear cycle, which is, I mean, it's a classic thing. It's in 1984. You know, it's like the constant bombardment with these stories of some war or some event that's happening overseas, and that just kind of keeps you in this perpetual state of fear and unknowing. And from the ashes of that, though, must emerge, I think, a better way, which is the Bitcoin way. And I mean, that's the thing that gives me hope ultimately, is that we have you know, just a fairer system and all it entails. And perhaps that's, again, me being a bit utopian. And I'm always looking, I'm seeking out counterpoints to this. And some of the people around me are very good at helping with that, because I think you do need to temper the utopianism somewhat, because there's always going to be unforeseen consequences and effects, which, even if we become hyper-Bitcoinized, so what does that mean? You know, what are the things that we haven't anticipated? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the goals of this show and just discussions with other people, is to find out what the envelope of discussion looks like. Just like before, we didn't know what communication really meant. It was all these fragmented things. What does value mean? And that's the transformation of value. That's the podcast. It's pulling that thread all the way back until we get to where it starts. And what we discover along the way is what I'm seeking out.
It's really interesting, because it's such a, I find it a really interesting concept. Like, because I think that the name hits the nail on the head for me, right? Which is that I think that's what Bitcoin does. It transforms value from what we are told, because of course fiat is money by decree. That's what it means in Latin. It's money by decree because somebody's told you it is. So that's what, you know, this is what you will value. What Bitcoiners say as well, we've created a system that values egalitarianism and fairness and trustlessness, and it's backed by the energy that's put into it. So now let's transact using that as our means of transfer of value. Transfer, not transformation. And so what we want to do is like we did with churches hundreds of years ago, we want to separate money from the state. And I think that offers the opportunity to keep states more honest and keep our leaders, politicians, let's face it, not all of them are very apt leaders, keeps them honest, because there is a true way for people to vote in a general election, but also they have a way to vote with their wallet, which is that if a government loses the confidence of its public, that public can easily sidestep the government's spending by not engaging with the system that they've created to extract value from its citizenry. And so I think that's what Bitcoin offers, and this is where you're talking about a utopian kind of perspective. Well, I think I've used this example several times before, but like, what would happen if you gave 0.1 of a Bitcoin to every North Korean? What would happen if you gave enough Bitcoin to every Russian that they could extract themselves from the ruble and stop spending money on tax that goes to buying weapons to invade their neighbors. What happens if you give 0.1 of the Bitcoin to everybody in Ghana who have a currency crisis, Venezuela who suffer under a very poorly administered government? All of that, all of those countries could use a Bitcoin standard to remove themselves from a state that is doing the worst possible job of administering a society to their citizens.
Well, I mean, on that note, something that's really important to identify, I think, is there is a distinction between there's the state as a concept, there's the government as a clearly defined institution, and then there's the society and the people. And for example, just next door, there's a Russian woman that I work with sometimes on various projects. And for me, the war in Ukraine, that whole thing, I look at it and I see her, and it's like she's absolutely against the war. Yet, in the eyes of the media, as a Russian, she comes under the category of Putin's government.
It's really rough. It's really horrible, because I totally understand.
People get swept into the category.
Well, unfortunately, you know, it does require Russians to go to war. Like, Putin's not the one out there fighting every single Ukrainian. He sent Russian citizens. And to an extent, they're a volunteer army. So there's some
complexity there, but it's
very complicated.
It's also, people are being, you know, pulled into this. I guess what I'm saying is the government as a defined institution is both posing as quite separate, but also as representative of the whole. And I would say the same for New Zealand. Like, you know, I'm personally, you know, I look at the New Zealand government, I'm like, okay, I'm not super happy about a lot of these things. It's not that I'm unhappy with New Zealand. They are not New Zealand. They are a bunch of people up the top of, you know, at the other end of Wellington and in the Beehive, doing this stuff, the politicians, the bureaucrats. They aren't New Zealand. They are a subset. But they do the affinity scam, say, okay, we are New Zealand. But they just happen to be the government of New Zealand. And the state, which I think is the larger concept, which is more ambiguous, which encompasses all things, including the court system, you know, the general law, the way New Zealand operates across all of these various institutions. I mean, that's one layer above that. And that's actually quite separate. Like, the courts do their own thing, you know, like the Reserve Bank, for example. I mean, that's not the government. That's its own thing. It's under the kind of the umbrella of the state, which ultimately is the monarchy, but at the top of that. But the government itself doesn't have the authority, I think, in many places like North Korea, to actually be representative of the people. But because it has the affinity scam and it has the power mechanism, it can control the people, because the people are actually good people.
Well, 2 points. Democracy is the tyranny of the masses, as we know, right? And so we voted by a margin for this government, and we are stuck with them until we can change that. I'm not saying that that's something, I'm not going to wade into a conversation about that. But the second is that you bring up the judiciary. There's the legislature, the judiciary, and the executive, and they all work to keep checks and balances on each other, right? The executive, which is your police, etc., they will only arrest people when they know that a law is just. They will only bring those cases in front of courts when they know that the application of that law will be just, and the judiciary interprets the legislature's laws for their own fairness. So everybody's got checks and balances on how they work. I think, again, Bitcoin is the opportunity to create a check and balance on a reserve bank by saying, well, we have a secondary monetary system here, which we can use to opt out of yours if we think you're unfair. So when you raise interest rates to 20%, well, that's not fair. We're going to exit your monetary system for another one until you get interest rates under control, inflation under control, the value of our currency back under control. We can opt out. And that's actually quite massive for countries where the administration of the financial system is extremely, extremely poor. You might feel cross, like I do, that there is an engineered recession where the impact of the last 10 or 12 years was kind of blindingly obvious to anybody who was paying attention, that we were ramping up to a high inflation environment because of effectively what happens when you spend a huge amount of money in a short amount of time as a government, and you have extraordinarily low interest rates for as long as you have them. It's a recipe for what we're living through at the moment. That being said, you can see how they got to where they are. I think that in some countries, Venezuela, Ghana, Zimbabwe, other examples I love to roll out, Turkey's another great one. At the end of the day, these countries need a secondary system that citizens can just step into to avoid poor management and planning by the people who are often not even elected.
Yeah, I'd say just two things on that. Number one, I think the split, separation of powers that you discussed, I think there's actually some challenges there, like with New Zealand. Like, I know certainly in the United States that was the intention of a innovative system to split those, separate those powers out, judiciary, executive, and legislative. But I think in New Zealand, certainly there is some division of those powers, but it certainly inherits a lot of the legacy biases of, you know, sort of English law and the way English society was structured, you know, a long time ago. And so the independence of executive and judiciary, I mean, it's not clear to me, compared to, say, the United States, what that looks like. But I guess what I'm interested in is, what does innovation look like in that space? And just like you said, with Bitcoin providing optionality to the financial system, the Reserve Bank, I mean, what does innovation in government look like? And one thing that I am interested in is applying software development principles to government. And this sounds a bit strange, but like the way software is developed has massively improved and innovated over the last 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you've got things like the separation of the front end and the back end. So the way a website looks and the actual functionality that it does are two different things, and they're connected with APIs. And there's a way to do it, and it's the right way, and it's gotten better over time. And mm-hmm. I often wonder, you know, you look at, you know, these kind of silly, in a way, things, you know, like the MPs, you know, the leather chairs that they've got, the way they sit, the whole system. It's like, yeah, it's a legacy system, and legacy is good. You know, I don't propose throwing things out the window, but it's also like, where can innovation come in? Like MMP, like that's a great innovation, right, that New Zealand was able to execute on. What other innovations are there where we can actually say, look, you know, this isn't really working. We're getting an impasse here with legislation. Actually, what's the best way around this? Mm. Where are the actual checks and balances? Why is our court system, which is supposed to be independent, still taking heaps of, you know, input from the government of the day when it comes to sentencing or kind of political actions? And it's like, there's all of these things where it's like, okay, what does innovation look like? And how do you even activate that? And that's where democracy comes in, because it is a function that enables kind of change and revision over time.
Mm.
And locking things in is also quite dangerous. So yeah, it's finding the balance between those two.
Yeah. I'm going to disagree with you on the point about interference in our courts by our government. I'd like to see some evidence for that.
Yeah, sure.
Cody,
yeah,
please provide me
some receipts.
Yeah, that's right. I'd like to see where that happens. I think, and I've seen good evidence myself of where this government has left prosecution and sentencing to the relevant arms of the government. I think you can, I'd be disagreeing on that. But your other point, where can innovation happen? I think law as code is where the best opportunity for innovation comes from, right? So law that is self-executing in a fashion, and that its variables are defined such that they're well understood and executable like a piece of code.
Yeah.
And that starts with plain language law, which is something I did some work with a lawyer a few years ago around law as code, but also plain language law, because the big barrier to access to law is the way it's written. Right, and it's written like its own language in code, in that it's very specific, it's very structured around the way it says things, and it has to be really clear how it defines its variables, and it's grown up a language of its own around this. The problem is that there are probably better ways to articulate this stuff now that we kind of have a very strong handle on all sorts of languages, not just written, but technical languages like software.
Well, it's a speciality, and I know certainly actually a gentleman who I did a bit of work with. He's a leading human rights lawyer in New Zealand, and so was quite involved with the repealing of the three strikes law and a few other things like that. And you know, I have a drink with him every now and then, and learning about how much, I mean, the definition of language and just the minutiae of this legal talk, that the kind of the process and the dance of it all, you know, it's all very formalistic. And I find that very interesting, because it would frustrate me to no ends if it was me doing that. But there's also sort of the flip side of that, though, is that within that there's a certain kind of precedent set that, you know, this is the way that it needs to be, this is the language we use, and you kind of have to plug into that. And it avoids this kind of almost the DAO kind of Ethereum DAO hack type, you know, coder's law kind of absolutes, which I think can also be dangerous, where there's no room to sort of twist someone's arm through logical reasoning or arguing around a point, which you kind of get that flexibility with the system at the moment. Like, you can actually justify and create cases where, if it was purely just like mechanical, logical, algebraic, you'd almost lead to a certain kind of AI tyranny, where it's like, you know, you just have this overlord of code that just justifies all things.
Yeah. I think some laws will lend themselves to being codified, no pun intended, more so than others, right? Speeding tickets, pretty easy.
Well, but even then, I mean, I often come out, you know, one of my kind of deep reads is, you know, Plato's Republic, and the search for justice, you know, within the individual can be scaled up to the search for justice within a society and a city and a country. And the idea of a, you know, what is just and what is justice? I mean, basically his conclusion is we need philosopher kings to lead society, which are people who, you know, are reluctantly in charge, who have gone through the journey of the philosopher, the journey of the warrior, all of these things to become leaders. And it's a very nuanced and humanist approach. And I think it could perhaps be dangerous to take the technological role, where it's like, we're gonna make this code as law, and it becomes this kind of, you know, you got these like robocops going around, you know, terminating people or something, you know, because they didn't pay their fines.
Judge Dredd.
Judge Dredd. Whereas the humanist approach is like, well, look, you know, we've actually got this society, which is a guy, and his thing is coming back to education as well. It's like, well, how do you educate a society to build philosopher kings? And that's where Bitcoin comes in, because it promotes long-term thinking. It promotes all of these kinds of self-introspections, which ultimately, if that filters out at large to society, which I believe it can, you have a more well-educated society, people generally behave better, and people kind of understand why they're here, how they got to where they are. And it allows, you know, interpretation, because sometimes, you know, there's a situation where it's like, well, we do need to actually have a special case for this person. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't just paint everyone under the same brush, which is kind of the Malthusian mechanical kind of late capitalist approach, where everyone's just a unit of labor, and if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you're going to go to jail, which is, I don't know, it seems a bit anti-human.
It does, yeah.
Wow.
It's an intense rant, man.
Yeah,
I liked your segue back to Bitcoin at the end there. I thought that was very good. I guess I don't have much to add, other than I don't really consider myself like a legal philosopher. So all I kind of think is that it does seem like a very antiquated system, and in a world where we have worked really hard to digitize everything else because of the efficiency gain, we still run an effectively an entirely human government and judicial sector.
Well, I mean, one analogy here would be, earlier in the conversation I was talking about the AML and the KYC automation, and you know what, I would be kind of open to the government being purely paper-based and being purely offline, and having thousands of secretaries and workers and clerks and people who are just moving papers around, if it meant that you weren't able to run the systematic persecution of certain people, which is happening in places like China, through this digital technology. And so, I mean, that's the importance of these kinds of conversations, to be like, well, look, what does an alternative look like? What is a bureaucracy, which, you know, bureau, it's like desk, you know, that's where it comes from. It's like thousands of people at desks stamping papers that don't really mean anything, but the ability to cross-reference databases is basically nil in that system. It's very time intensive. And so there's actually the ability for people to disappear through the system and not be, you know, have their whole life tied up in one mistake, for example. Whereas at the moment with the KYC stuff, one mistake, you're out, you know. That's a kind of tyranny. And I think at least having the conversation, and you say you're not a legal philosopher, but philosophy is the discourse of ideas, discussion. I mean, this is what it's about. And I think Bitcoin enables this as kind of offering a second place to stand. And just like we were saying, you know, with communication, now that we've got a second place to stand and to look at what the existing system is, we can actually judge it and discuss it and dissect it in a better way.
I totally agree. I mean, like having this second monetary system to use to compare and contrast the good and bad of the other system has to be extremely useful to anybody who's observing it, right? I mean, you know, you've got Augustine from the Bank of International Settlements over the last couple of days saying that, you know, crypto has lost its battle against CDBCs when I don't think we've even started.
The battle hasn't started
yet. We haven't even started putting our gear on. I just think that is crazy because the Bitcoin system has never been stronger, more widely adopted, more poised to take market share from the existing system. I saw there's a good tweet from Lynn Alden the other day, She posted that Fedwire, which is basically the backbone of the US financial system, settled $1 quadrillion in 2022. That was all done for profit, right? I don't know what the average fee was on $1 quadrillion, probably 1%, something like that, but that's still an obscene amount of money, right? It doesn't matter how much was settled at any percentage of $1 quadrillion. Somebody made a huge amount of money over the velocity of money in that country. And that is the, in my view, that's the TAM, the total addressable market for Bitcoin in the United States. And then you scale that to the whole world. Like, because the Fedwire is the backbone of the system. That's what L1 Bitcoin is, right? Trustless peer-to-peer payments, remittances in this case, where you're settling an average of $5 million per transaction. Like, Bitcoin is absolutely perfect for that. Perfectly secure, perfectly peer-to-peer, no delay, incredibly cheap to run per transaction in that regard. It's like a no-brainer for me. Like, you put Bitcoin next to Fedwire and you go, why would anybody use Fedwire for that if they had the alternative?
Bitcoin wins.
Bitcoin wins.
All right. Thank you. That's Dr. Simon Collins visiting Wellington here. Nice catch up. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Cody. Always a pleasure.